move to the third case this morning, Gurevich versus SG. Gurevich.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Cody Marvin, on behalf of Plaintiff Appellant Ron Gurevich. This is an appeal and a Social Security disability claim. The administrative law judge who decided Mr. Gurevich's claim made several errors that require reversal in this case. The first of those is the ALJ's evaluation of the credibility of Mr. Gurevich and his wife. Mrs. Gurevich testified on his behalf about the problems that he was having as a result of PTSD prior to his date last insured. The ALJ gave three reasons, all of which were insufficient. The first of those was that she was related to the claimant. The ALJ didn't give any specific reasons for explaining why that made her testimony incredible. He seemed to operate under a presumption that because she was related, she had some interest, and therefore her testimony was unreliable. The administration, in ruling SSR 06-03P, explains that ALJs are required to take this testimony from family members, people close to the claimant, under consideration, because they may have more experience with the person that doesn't show up in medical records.
Right, but he's not required to believe it.
He is not required to believe it, but, as I said, there's no presumption that that testimony is going to be reliable. And in the decision, he doesn't go through and give any specific reasons, like that she had lied about something else in the past or anything like that. The second reason was that she had no medical training. Now, that is also an error. Again, the rulings and regulations require the ALJs to consider testimony from lay sources because it may be based on special knowledge. The ALJ said that because she didn't have medical training, she couldn't make exacting observations about his condition. But that's not correct. The two of them lived together, and they were close to each other. Some of the reasons she gave and some of the examples she gave of his condition were very specific. She talked about how in 1993, when he had transferred jobs, he started to change. His condition worsened. He got meaner. She gave a very specific incident. She said it was from either 1993 or 1994. Both of those dates were after he had switched jobs and before he had stopped working. She said that they had been at a Vietnam veterans reunion. They were sleeping in the same bed. She woke up in the middle of the night, and he had his hands around her neck. She said from that date forward, they didn't sleep in the same bed anymore. That's a very specific bit of testimony. So the ALJ's reliance on her lack of medical training and her inability to detect, you know, any specific changes in his condition was incorrect. The third reason the ALJ gave was that it wasn't supported by objective evidence. Now, SSR 96-7P explains that on its own is not a good reason for rejecting a witness's testimony. So all three of the reasons the ALJ gave for rejecting her testimony were improper. The ALJ also rejected Mr. Gurevich's testimony, giving two reasons. The first was that he didn't get treatment prior to the date last insured. Now, the problem with that is that ALJs are only required to make credibility determinations when the objective evidence doesn't support their claims. So the fact that the objective evidence didn't support it was really just the reason the ALJ needed to make the credibility determination in the first place. And as the ruling explains, the lack of supporting objective evidence is not a good reason to deny a person's allegations. The second reason the ALJ gave was that a plaintiff had engaged in some daily activities. But those daily activities were minimal. They included driving, shopping, gardening. And Mr. Gurevich testified at the hearing that there were limitations even on those minimal activities, that he drove very rarely, that he couldn't drive on the expressway because it made him too nervous. He went shopping once in a while, but he did so very early in the morning so he could avoid the crowds. And with gardening, he explained that gardening was kind of a form of therapy for him. It was something he could do on his own terms, at his own pace. It was something he was comfortable doing. Another part about that is that, you know, he suffered from PTSD, which is an episodic condition. You know, it's not going to be constant, but the person is going to have serious problems from time to time. The ALJ didn't appear to take that into account. The second error is the ALJ didn't apply ruling SSR 8320. This ruling applies where a claimant is disabled, but there is no evidence from prior to the date last insured or from earlier that directly supports that. The ruling requires ALJs to, because there is no objective evidence, it requires them to place more emphasis on a person's allegations and other non-medical history, such as work history, and any other evidence that comes into the record. So in this case, Dr. Rosenfeld testified. She was the medical expert at the hearing. She testified that he was disabled at least as of 2003. The ALJ accepted her opinion that he was disabled then. However, the ALJ didn't go through and apply the analysis required by SSR 8320. So really his whole denial of these allegations was based on a lack of objective evidence. But the reason SSR 8320 exists is because the administration wants to recognize that there are cases where there is no objective evidence, but a person was still disabled prior to that date. Now, in this case, we had there was a retrospective opinion from his treating psychologist who explained that after 2 years of treatment, he recognized that the plaintiff had been disabled as of at least 1995. Now, this was corroborated by plaintiff's own testimony and the testimony of his wife. As this court has held in Allard v. Barnhart and Wilder v. Apfel, a retrospective opinion combined with corroborating lay evidence is sufficient for a finding of disability, a retrospective finding of disability. The ALJ's decision is also inconsistent regarding the effects of plaintiff's mental impairments. This case is similar to another case this court decided, Parker v. Astrew. In that case, the ALJ recognized that a claimant had PTSD and found at step two of the sequential evaluation that that was a severe impairment. Severe impairment meaning that it has significant limitations on work-related function. Now, the ALJ went through, but then at the residual functional capacity determination said, well, all the effects of this impairment surfaced after the date last insured. Now, the same case existed here. ALJ said in the first place that he had three distinct mental impairments, severe mental impairments, PTSD, depression, and an anxiety disorder. So all of these would significantly limit his ability to function in a work environment. And the ALJ went through and ultimately in the residual functional capacity determination only included physical limitations. There were no mental limitations included there.
Why can't that inconsistency be explained in terms of the fact that this is a retrospective look? That the ALJ was making the step two findings about his current condition and step four about the as of the date last insured.
I think it can't be explained because the ALJ didn't explain it. The ALJ here, Judge Armstrong, was an administrative law judge for a long time. So he was not, it's not as though he didn't understand what he meant when he said these were severe impairments. So we don't really know what he was thinking, and he didn't explain throughout, well, this is severe, but what I really meant to say at this point was that it was severe at this point and not this point or anything like that. There was no explanation throughout the opinion that that was the case. He said it's severe, and the next step said that in three functional categories, he had mild limitations. Even the administration even requires ALJs to explain what those mild limitations are in the residual functional capacity assessment. Now, the ALJ didn't even do that. He said severe in the first place, meaning causing significant limitation, and then went through at the RFC residual functional capacity assessment and didn't explain it at all. The last thing was Dr. Ballinger's opinion. That was the treating source. I'd like to point out that while the district court acknowledged that the ALJ didn't properly evaluate Dr. Ballinger's opinion according to the requirements of the regulations, the district court stated that The ALJ's rejection was correct because Dr. Ballinger hadn't treated plaintiff prior to the day last insured. Now, as I stated before, this court in Wilder v. Apfel and Allard v. Barnhart has stated that a retrospective opinion combined with lay testimony is sufficient for a finding that a claimant is disabled. If there are no more questions.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Chad Troop, and I'm on behalf of Michael J. Astrew, Commissioner of Social Security. Of critical importance to this case is the fact that Mr. Granovich's insured status under the Social Security Act expired on December 31st, 2000. Thus, in order to establish his entitlement to disability benefits, Mr. Granovich was required to prove that he became disabled on or before December 31st, 2000. It should also be noted that this Court has repeatedly recognized that it's axiomatic that the claimant bears the burden of supplying adequate records and evidence to prove their claim of disability. And the Social Security Act and the regulations both provide that a claimant bears the burden of furnishing medical evidence and other evidence to prove their disability. In this case, ALJ reasonably determined that Mr. Granovich failed to sustain his burden of showing that he was disabled prior to his date last insured. I want to discuss a few of the facts of this case because I think they're important to understand the timeline here. In this case, shortly after Mr. Granovich served in the Vietnam War, he complained of nervousness and tremors and rapid heartbeat, which was diagnosed with a mild anxiety reaction. This was in 1969. But then the ALJ noted that Mr. Granovich did not complain of any ongoing symptoms and did not seek any ongoing psychological treatment over the next 34 years. It wasn't until June 2003 that he presented for further treatment, and that was 2 days after, or 2 years after his date last insured. During that period of time, between when Mr. Granovich testified that he first started experiencing symptoms, he was able to work for 25 years for U.S. Steel as a computer operator. He worked for his employer for 30 years until 1995, when he became eligible to retire, and he took a lump sum retirement payment in 1995. The ALJ noted that Mr. Granovich did not present any evidence that he had any on-the-job difficulties prior to retiring. The ALJ also noted that there is no evidence that his condition worsened at any time around the time where he decided to take a lump sum retirement payment. The ALJ noted that Mr. Granovich did not seek any treatment during his alleged period of disability from 1995 to 2000, and it was until June 2003. Two and a half years after his date last insured, that he sought any psychological treatment for his post-traumatic stress disorder. When he eventually did present for treatment in 2003, Mr. Granovich identified the terrorist attacks of September 11th, 2001, and the war in Iraq in 2003 as events that triggered his post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms. Despite the fact that Mr. Granovich did not seek any treatment for his post-traumatic stress disorder until after his date last insured, he now attempts to establish disability by relying solely on his own testimony, the testimony of his wife, and a retrospective medical source opinion from Dr. Ballinger, who didn't begin treating Mr. Granovich until years after his date last insured. In that sense, this case is analogous to the facts of Eidstad v. Astrew, in which this court found that that the ALJ reasonably found that the claimant had not established that he was disabled prior to his date last insured. Both Granovich and Eichstad failed to produce any relevant medical evidence from the period of time predating the dates last insured, and thus relied solely on subjective testimony and retrospective opinions in support of their disability applications. Now, Granovich has criticized the ALJ's credibility finding. However, in contrast to his arguments, the ALJ's credibility finding was well supported by the record. The ALJ found that his allegations were not corroborated by the medical evidence of record, and consistent with this court's holdings in Eichstad and in Parker, it was entirely reasonable for the ALJ to discount his allegations because they were not supported by the medical evidence. And Granovich has claimed that they cannot discount because there's no medical evidence, but that's just incorrect. Assertion. You know, it's well established that when there's not medical evidence to support allegations, that that can be used as a factor. It shouldn't be the only factor, but it's certainly one of the major factors that ALJ regularly consider. The ALJ also considered inconsistencies with the evidence between Mr. Granovich's assertions and the evidence of record. For example, whereas he testified that his symptoms worsened when he transferred job locations, he inconsistently reported that his symptoms had worsened after September 11th and after the war in Iraq. And likewise, he testified that he had hand tremors and choppiness in his voice that affected his ability to work in 95. However, the medical records show that he reported that those symptoms did not arise until after his date last insured. The ALJ also considered his work history as a credibility factor and found that although he testified that his post-traumatic stress disorder got bad in 1993, Granovich was nonetheless able to continue working until 1995 when he was eligible to take his retirement payment. He also considered his daily activities as one factor. For example, he was able to serve as a primary caregiver for his elderly mother during his alleged period of disability, which tended to suggest that he wasn't rendered completely disabled by his, or that his impairments weren't as disabling as alleged. Granovich has criticized the ALJ's consideration of the relationship with his wife in discounting his wife's credibility. But it's important to note the ALJ just stated that Ms. Granovich cannot be considered a disinterested third party. And I think that's a fully reasonable conclusion that the ALJ can draw, that as his wife, she's not a disinterested third party. The ALJ didn't base his credibility finding solely on that marital relationship. He's also criticized that he discounted the wife because she was not medically trained. However, this is also not an unreasonable observation, as ALJ was recognizing that the value of her testimony is limited to her lay observations. Ms. Granovich testified that he became meaner. However, that doesn't give a detailed description of how severe his post-traumatic stress disorder is. The value of her testimony was her lay observations, not as a medical expert, and the ALJ was recognizing that. But the ALJ specifically said that the most important thing in evaluating Ms. Granovich's testimony was that it was inconsistent with the medical evidence. And as I just discussed, all the reasons that applied to Mr. Granovich's testimony, those applied equally to Ms. Granovich's testimony, as their testimony was essentially redundant. And so all the reasons given for Mr. Granovich's testimony also apply to Mrs. Granovich's testimony.
Could you address the tension between the Step 2 and Step 4 treatment of mental impairments?
Sure. At Step 2, the ALJ found that he did have severe impairments of post-traumatic stress disorder and anxiety disorder, but Granovich has focused only on the initial RFC finding, which found no mental limitations. However, he completely ignores that the ALJ later on made an alternative RFC finding at Step 4 and Step 5. And in this alternative RFC finding, the ALJ essentially accommodated Mr. Granovich's subjective complaints that he made at the hearing. At the hearing, he said he was unable to work because he couldn't stand working around other people. So in order to accommodate those subjective complaints, the ALJ made an alternative RFC finding and found that and limited him to only superficial interaction with coworkers, supervisors, and the general public. There's no evidence in the record to support Mr. Granovich's testimony, so I believe that's why he did not include it in his initial RFC finding, but the ALJ later gave the benefit of the doubt in his alternative RFC finding.
What's the commissioner's position on the relationship between Step 2 and Step 4 in this regard? Basically responded to the question by taking refuge in the alternative finding, but I think the legal question still remains on the table.
I mean, I think this court has recognized that alternative RFC findings are fully appropriate, and that the court should affirm the ALJ's decision.
I'm not questioning that.
Okay.
I'm asking for you to engage the legal
question. Well, okay. Well, one important part. At Step 2, it's merely a threshold inquiry. As long as the ALJ identifies one severe impairment and then moves past Step 2, then the question of whether or not he identified enough impairments at Step 2 is really irrelevant, as long as he goes on and considers all those impairments at the later steps. And this court held that in Castile v. Astru. And here the ALJ identified a severe impairment at Step 2, and then he proceeded to consider all of Mr. Granovich's impairments at the later steps. So when he considered his complaints and limitations at step four, I mean, that was, consistent with this court's holding that, as long as he considers these at the later steps, that step two inquiry is, it doesn't matter as much what he identifies at step two.
Okay, so I take that to be a statement that the commissioner's position is that there does not need to be consistency between findings at step two and step four.
Well, no, I think that they are consistent because, I mean, the ALJ, when he was identifying the step two, at step two when he was identifying the severe impairments, he was recognizing that he did later in the decision find that there were severe limitations from those mental disorders. So if he had not identified that and then later on gone and found that there were severe impairments, then... I mean, I think that they are fully consistent because he identified the severe impairments at step two and then later found limitations. It doesn't have to be...
Well, that's not quite right, at least because the preliminary step four finding, in essence, finds no mental impairments, right?
Well, at step, three where he determines the...
We skip step three.
In between step three where
arguing.
He determines the RFC... finding.
I'm sorry?
When he first initially found the RFC finding, he did not find any mental limitations because there was no evidence that he had any mental limitations.
Okay, but we've got the step two finding. It's a low threshold, more than minimal effects, right?
Yes.
So why shouldn't we require ALJs at least to explain at step four why they're not including impairments they've already said were severe?
I understand that this is probably not typical in the way that occurs. I mean, it's not no. commonplace for the ALJs to necessarily make alternative RFC findings, and I think that this was just a unique in that he later identified. I don't think it matters that he changed the RFC finding at step five. I think these were two RFC findings that, were both, could be made at the same point. It's not necessarily that he, had to change it later on.
I understand your desire to rely on the alternative holding, and that may well be correct. But along the way, it's a little hard to understand. Let me ask again why we should not require an ALJ at least to explain why he's leaving out an impairment at step four that he found severe at step two.
Okay. I think really, the law in the Seventh Circuit says, you need to read the decision as a whole. And I think that the ALJ's decision as a whole makes sense as to why he classified those impairments as severe at step two, because he later found that there were severe limitations coming from those impairments in his alternatives.
Does the commissioner have a position on this legal issue?
To my knowledge, I don't know that there's anything that specifically addresses this issue. But I think that the decision read as a whole is fully consistent, and I don't think that there's a big legal significance of the fact that
I don't think you can argue that the decision as a whole is fully consistent. I think you may be able to argue that the decision as a whole is sustainable on the standard of review. But that doesn't address the issue of the consistency that the petitioner here has raised, the claimant has raised, that the step two and step four findings are hard to reconcile.
Okay.
And maybe we're pressing the commissioner to take a stand that the commissioner doesn't want to take a stand on, but it is a legal issue that's in play and has been ruled on by other circuits.
Okay.
So maybe you're not prepared to take a position on behalf of the commissioner, but
okay. I think in the alternative, if the ALJ had not found this impairment to be severe at step two, and then had later identified severe limitations at step four and step five, I mean that would
that's the reverse of what we have here.
Exactly, but I mean I think that would.
That's an error that will never prejudice the claimant.
That's right.
So.
Okay. I think that the ALJ here, recognized that he was later going to give the benefit of the doubt to the claimant. And so at step two, he recognized it as a severe impairment that it caused severe limitations because he later identified severe limitations. And so, you know, I think that was consistent.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.
Time. Your time is out, but we'll, since we gave your opponent extra time, we'll give you 2 minutes.
To address one thing quickly. About your concern about the commissioner's position about step two and step four, the commissioner does have a position on that. In 20 CFR 1523, 404-1523, the administration explains that the RFC determination must account for all limitations, even those that are not considered severe. So the decision has to be consistent from step two through the end of the decision. Also, in Social Security Ruling 85-16, the administration says the residual functional capacity assessment must include limitations from all mental impairments.
Yeah, that doesn't really, neither of those regulations really addresses the problem here, though.
Okay.
You have to say that the ALJ has to address all limitations, just sort of a generic.
But it's that the decision has to be consistent throughout. I think that's what those are intending to address. As far as the alternative, as far as the alternative RFC finding, the ALJ didn't make an alternative finding. I think he said, it's at the record page 18, he says, if I added limitations on social interaction, then this. He didn't actually make a finding. And second, even if that does account for the mild impairments in social functioning, it doesn't account for the impairments the ALJ found earlier in concentration, persistence, or pace, or activities of daily living. So it doesn't account for all functional limitations. So the commissioner can't say that it's harmless error on that basis. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thanks to both counsel. Case is taken under advisement. We move to the